We welcome to the show our friend, the talented writer Colin Fleming. His latest book is If You Brackets, Fabula Fantasy Effery. Hope it is available wherever fine books are sold. Good day, Mr. Fleming.
How's it going, Kimball?
I'm doing all right, thank you. It's sunny, it's beautiful, and as you tweeted about earlier today, those scents of spring, and they're a little different than what our olfactories take in the fall.
What a beautiful tweet, right, Kimball?
Yes.
So poetic.
Yes.
So spot-on, accurate, true. The smell of autumn is... You don't really get the autumn smell. I know you're a big November fan until around that time, because that... aroma we associate with the season, I think, is really, it's decaying leaves. So it's not enough for the leaves to fall. They have to marinate in the ground a bit. And then in spring, you have that wet soil smell. I think that's the telltale aroma of spring. The invisible freshets of rebirth, as I put it on that Twitter today. That's what I got a nose full of as I was heading out to run my stairs.
And much like fall, I love this time of year because the mornings are crisp and sometimes just outright cold, but the air is it's so powerful and I think so invigorating. The warm days and then those cool, sometimes cold nights as well.
I'm a winter guy. I don't like the sun. In fact, since this whole switch 2.5 weeks ago, whenever it was, I've been a little messed up. I like a lot of darkness in the morning. And I like when it gets dark early. I know you like to lotion up with like the baby oil, lie out on the beach, nice and crispy, as you put it.
No.
But I'm not, I'm a big sweat guy. Sometimes I even take photos of my sweat puddle at the base of the stairs. But I'm a workout sweat guy. I'm not a walk around sweat guy and just feeling nasty and gross and not a fan of that. So I get a little apprehensive this time of the year, but also I like it too, because you can really start looking forward to Christmas again. I feel like now it's behind us. Now it's that good time to look forward to Christmas when you can enjoy the anticipation, even though I'm completely alone, but you don't have to sweat that it's going to be over soon, which I get really nervous about. So it's a ripe Christmas season, I'd say.
Let me just clarify. There's no baby oil here. I am the poster child for what we in Maine refer to as the farmer's tan.
Oh, is that a reference to your Speedo?
No, God, no. No, no, no. There's no Speedo. No, 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 God.
I picture you all like on your front on a beach, but that's not enough with the legs spread apart. They call it the Kimball Flying V of the beach. Or the downward V, like downward dog for yoga. This won't surprise people, but I'm not.
Me and my thong doing what we do out there. Yeah. Goodness. Let's move on to more pleasant things, including, let's start with this. I have no idea what I watched, but I enjoyed the heck out of Shakes versus Shav, a sort of animated confrontation between William Shakespeare and George Bernard Shaw. Again, I don't know what I watched, but I enjoyed it.
I feel like I should charge you a culture tariff for all of the culture and art that I bring to your world,
yes,
your life, but otherwise just never would have been there. So what I gave you via that YouTube link was the 1949, I guess we should do some background. I gave you the closest approximation that one can find to what is one of the final works by George Bernard Shaw. And that was a 10-minute play in the Punch and Judy tradition. People know what that is, maybe, or look it up. But it was like this trope of theater in Europe for a long time, especially in England. And George Bernard Shaw really detested the writings of William Shakespeare. To put it in 2022 terms, he thought the man sucked at writing. Not sucked at writing, I shouldn't say that. He thought he had certain strengths, could turn a phrase, but that he was platitudinous, that his characters didn't have realistic solutions or approaches to their problems and would just wave them away with the flourish of a couplet. And so he wrote this 10-minute play that was performed in 1949, so right at the end for Shaw, who lived for a long, long time. It was a puppet play that entertained people and also made some points. It threw some punches, even literally, metaphorically, critically, and literally. So what I sent you was an attempt through animation and talking heads to do a reprise of this puppet show. So the way it happens is Shakespeare shakes, shaves, Shaw, step out on stage, and they start talking smack with each other. Now, it sort of disheartens me because the language that was meant to be pugilistic and earthy and for the folk of the time, as I was watching this again today, I was thinking like, Jesus, I don't know anyone who could understand this. This is pretty like depressing because it's just conversational speech in a way. And it starts with, well, they punch each other out. And it's funny because when Shakespeare punches out Shaw, he's all vainglorious and he leans over him and he's counting out like up to 10 to celebrate his victory, which does not come.
I also enjoyed the battle between Rob Roy and Macbeth.
Oh, so they're when they're talking to smack and Shakespeare's like, yo, you're my bitch. There's no one who could, you couldn't do Macbeth. And then Shaw, like, wow, I didn't do it, but this other person did. And so Macbeth shows up and Rob Roy, and they're going to battle it out now. And it's funny because there's a physical humor in this, too, where Macbeth is beheaded after there's like this elaborate wind-up, like throwing the shot put or a hammer and pirouette. And then there goes the sword blade and Macbeth is like, oh, I don't even like it here anyway. I'm going back to Shakespeare's hometown, get a nice room at a hotel. It's cheaper there anyway. And he picks up his head, tucks it under his arm. But it is amusing when Macbeth, he does his thing, lay on. And I think we should help people out. When you quote lay on, it's a fun thing to quote, right? It doesn't mean like on guard, have at it. It means after you, sir. So it's a little misleading with that, but it's like you're so confident in your victory with your blade that you let the other person strike first before you do your thing.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown on this Tuesday afternoon. Up next, let's discuss another piece of art that you introduced me to, a really wonderful cover of Radiohead's Creep by Prince.
Yes. So this would be from 2008, and we might not associate Prince with Radiohead, and Radiohead themselves would be keen not to be associated with Creep, which I think is, I just don't think that's a stance that has aged well or is going to age well. And everything I see written about Creep is like everything I see written about the Grateful Dead. It's wrong. And I'll see all these critics saying, well, Creep is nothing like the sophisticated music that Radiohead would later do. It's exactly like it. In fact, I would say that it's one of the best songs ever written. It's the kind of song that you would give your soul to write. It is easy to identify with. It is personal and particular. And so it appealed to Prince, certainly, and it has these famous dead notes in it. And these dead notes are when you, well, in this song, is when the guitarist takes his hand off of the frets and just sort of powers through the strings. So they don't really have like any associative value as notes. They're just like raw, pure sound. And that's the that we all know from the song Creep. So Prince kind of meows almost his way through the vocal and like he's singing to himself privately in the shower or whatever, the car, mumbling along almost, but people, like, some people know what the song is as they're listening at this festival, other people don't know. But when he plays his guitar and he gets past the dead notes, the tone of his guitar is, to me, it's like Hendrix. When a lot of the reaction to Hendrix back in 66 when he came up on the British scene was to his tone. No one had a tone like that. And tone is, as I also put on Twitter today, it's a bit like voice. And a story, an indelible voice. It could only come from that one person, that one character, that one narrator. So when you listen to this with Prince, this cover of the Radiohead song, the tone is just, you need a fraction of a bar to know it's him. I mean, the playing is like, oh, okay, so you're one of the four or five best people ever to pick up a guitar.
I thought of you the other day. I'm no meme guy, but I saw this on my, I think my Facebook or maybe my Twitter feed, and I thought of you, and it was It was designed around April Fool's Day, but I thought, well, the sentiment makes sense. It was a picture of Paul McCartney, and it said, someone asked me how it felt to be a member of the greatest band in the world, and I don't remember being in the Grateful Dead.
Oh, some wag put that up.
Yes,
huh?
Yes, yes.
And it's the Beatles never really said too much about the Grateful Dead for all of their time that they spent in California. Well, not like it was a ton of time, but they were there in that scene for a bit at least, as the Dead were getting started, and they weren't, they just didn't come up. I mean, you can usually find like overlap, like one band talking about another band. And the Beatles, for instance, when they did Helter Skelter, that was their attempt, or your man McCartney's attempt, to do a song like The Who, although it doesn't really sound anything like The Who at that time, 1968. But yes, the Grateful Dead to me, and I always make this connection, they're the rock and roll version of the Ellington Orchestra. The parallels are just uncanny. They really are. So how about maybe the best British band and then the best American band? They could have a transatlantic battle of the bands.
Oh, there you go. Well, speaking of music, a terrific piece in Jazz Times about the great Jelly Roll Morton, looking at some of his greatest performances. And is it safe to say, if Jelly Roll Morton didn't invent jazz, he certainly invented his own legend about his role in jazz?
Yes, I'd say that's fair. But I'd also say that he has a point in his claim that he was the person who came up with jazz. A lot of times you'll hear or read that Buddy Bolden was that person. But really, a lot of times when you come up with something, what you're doing is you're synthesizing, you're assimilating what is out there and giving it cohesive, unified voice. And so in that regard, as we were just talking about the Beatles didn't invent a lot of things, but they synthesized a lot of things. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm. Like the whole, even when you look at All You Need Is Love, that wasn't like the Beatles, like, oh, let's get into this whole like affection thing and Summer of Love. They just were able to pull together what was in the air. And Jelly Roll Morton was doing that in the 1920s in jazz. And he had this rough upbringing and knew how to take care of himself and was this pianist who can play in all of these different styles. So he had as much to do with jazz's birth as anyone, because he never really left that sort of classic New Orleans sound. And we associate jazz with New Orleans, but there isn't a lot of jazz in the New Orleans style from like the 20s. And that's what Jelly Roll Morton was doing, even when he wasn't recording in New Orleans and he was out and about in the world. So in the 20s, it was him and Armstrong. And Armstrong had gone up to Chicago, and he wasn't really playing New Orleans jazz anymore, Armstrong. He was doing his own modernistic thing. He was not synthesizing. He was creating just something completely new. So I wrote this piece looking at Morton's 10 best, let's say, 10 greatest performances.
And if you rank them, well, let's start with number 10. And by the way, this is available. This is pretty cool. This playlist is available if you go to Spotify. Just type in Jelly Roll Morton, and you can find Colin's top 10 performances. What's at number 10?
Oh, I don't even remember what I put at number 10. You told me.
It's the Murder Ballad.
Oh, yes. The Murder Ballad. Isn't that number one?
Well, on this it says number 10. Now, maybe they're ranked in inverse order.
Are you on Spotify or are you on Jazz Time?
I'm on Spotify.
See, I don't know anything about Spotify.
Oh, okay.
If that is... how it is in Spotify. They reversed them.
All right. So, well, maybe they're building up. Maybe they're starting at number one, which on their list is Black Bottom Stomp.
Yes. So okay. we can touch on all these. So like Jelly Roll Morton did, he recorded with this band that was one of the best small bands in early jazz, just this Kraken band. So they're quite, well, not quite a few, but there are a number of numbers from them in there. And the Murder Ballad, which is, I think this would surprise people because it runs to a half hour. And long tracks aren't something we associate with the recordings or even the recording possibilities of 1938. Mm. So he played with his band in the 20s, and he did some stuff alone. And Alan Lomax, who is one of the crucial, crucible figures in early American recorded sound, he would go around and he would record Sun House and Muddy Waters and all of these people in their natural environment, Woody Guthrie. And he did this with Jelly Roll Morton. Jelly Roll Morton was perfect for this kind of sit down, let's talk about music, you play me your stuff, because he was the teller of tall tales that were actually true. And the piece I referenced, Dizzy Dean, the Gas House Gang pitcher of the St. Louis Cardinals, said it's not bragging if it's true. And Jelly Roll Morton certainly exemplified that. So he would tell these stories about his life and illustrate them with music with Alan Lomax. So I included some from there. But the Murder Ballad is this. If you listen to it, you're probably surprised that that was what was being made at the time, right? The language is, it's like NWA language, right?
Right.
So Jelly Roll Morton is telling this story complete with curse words and everything that goes on for a half hour. He had other numbers too, like one is sort of like his party piece, like his show off virtuosity, Hendrix type piece for the piano was, Fingerbreaker, which is just such an apt title because to play this piano composition would just about break the pianist's fingers.
How important was Jelly Roll Morton in codifying jazz as an art when so much of it had been improvised and continued to be improvised, but to be able to have some standards so people could know, oh, hey, this is an example of a Jelly Roll Morton song.
True. And so I would say that in the 20s and 30s, jazz was song-based more so than improvisationally organized. Improvisation is something that we're going to associate with really the 60s, I think. I mean, you're getting improvisation. It's not like the players knew what their solo was, how they were going to play it before they actually started playing it oftentimes. But Morton was someone who gave credibility to just that idea of freestyle and writing. So he's this useful guy, this like multifactorial guy, because he was a songsmith. He really was. But he could also take, as we're talking about, that half minute or 30 minute song, he could extend that out and just jam in a way by himself. He's not with the band when he's with Alan Lomax, and it's just him at the piano. So to do anything for a half hour, to talk for a half hour, it's just like PowerPoint or something like that, you're improvising. And yet there's this song form in place. So you get an idea where someone like Bob Dylan would have listened to this and been like, oh, because Dylan really is doing something similar with Desolation Row, and Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands, but especially Desolation Row, because it's a story. And it's populated with so many different characters. And that's very much a Jelly Roll Morton thing. So he was this classic American songsmither who could also play the piano at this near matchless level. So you get this Tin Pan Alley sense with him, like before Tin Pan Alley, but also that he could just do whatever he needed to do to make something up on the spot.
Now, did he invent the barrel house piano sound or just perfect it?
I think he took it out further than maybe it was going at the time, because Jelly Roll Morton didn't have a lot of like stop lines. He was going to go for things. He was someone who was an inveterate envelope pusher. And if you listen to other sit downs that Alan Lomax had with other musicians, he doesn't seem or sound intimidated by them. And not that he's scared of Jelly Roll Morton, but there's a totally different vibe. Like, all right, this guy's a wild card. If we put him in rock and roll terms, we might think of like Jerry Lee Lewis, like with the persona and all that stuff, when Jerry Lee Lewis became the killer. And Jerry Lee Lewis wasn't even really, there's this, for instance, this bootleg of a show that Jerry Lee Lewis did in 1961. And the killer persona is not there. The killer persona only enters into it with him when he just doesn't give a bleep anymore. Like, everyone's kind of against him, and he's not, like, getting hits, and he's not into country yet. And he just says, screw it. I'm going to have this larger-than-life outsized personality, persona. So that's what Jelly Roll Morton was doing. But there really was not someone. The way I began the piece was by saying he was the first musician I ever listened to who made me think, is this guy for real? And that was partially because of how he played and his sound and his sense of himself. Because he was, again, I draw a comparison to, remember that Disney short, Pecos Bill? And he's like roping the tornado and everything. Jelly Roll Morton was a born tornado roper, jazz style.
Well, you can check out Colin's piece at jazztimes.com and go to Spotify for the playlist as well. Just remember that number one is not the greatest. It's 1 through 10. You'll figure it out when you're there. Trust me on that. Finally, we talk about an interesting film I had not seen before, a Canadian movie from, I think, 1983, that may be called Siege, sometimes referred to as self-defense. And this, boy, this was a slice of early 80s. I'm not even sure how to describe it. It was uncomfortable to watch at time. It was an odd film.
What made you think it was odd?
Just that time period. The language, it was pretty straightforward. Things that you would be uncomfortable hearing today. The out and out, the blatant homophobia, and then the whole revenge that takes place in the second half of the movie. It was an 80s film, both the good and the bad.
I don't know about that. I mean, a Quentin Tarantino film, and they're all lauded. The language is much more outre, much more potentially offensive. And I guess we should preface this by saying, lest it seems that I'm coming across as defending something, this film is about these out of work, like hard guys, like these conservative type guys who go into this gay bar and they're going to be like, we don't like you gays, we don't like you homosexuals and butt friends and all of that stuff. So I actually thought, like, the language, because it's in character, it's the premise of this film, that these people are going to come together in an apartment block, very desolate apartment. See, I think it's a very normal sort of mainstream, not shady and not particularly weird film. What strikes me about it is how efficient it is, how good it is, because you wouldn't think something from 1983. If I just said to anybody, there's a horror film from 1983, we think schlock and shock and some twist ending at the end where, what's the one, like Sleepaway Camp,
yeah,
where you find out the killer like rips down the pants and it's like, whoa, I wasn't expecting to see that there. It's like, good night, safe journey home. And the end of Friday the 13th from 1980 has that twist ending with the boat, and all of a sudden, like, the kid comes out of the water, that big gotcha moment. This was pretty sincere as a film, and I think it has something to do with where it's from.
Yeah.
The 1980s in Canada, you get these horror films that are well done. I mean, some are schlocky, like My Bloody Valentine, but you find these sort of like B-film dark gems. So this one guy makes it out of the gay bar, and he's pursued, and he ends up in an apartment with these people who are going to have to, like, adopt him for the night to try to defend themselves. And they let him come into the ranks and everything. And I am just fascinated by that kind of, like, temporary relationship, because I think a lot of relationships in life are temporary in nature. And so how are these people going to be together in the limited amount of time that their lives will overlap? And so I thought it was just, like, really effective, actually.
Well, one of the things I liked about it, because you wouldn't see this today, the guys in the New Order, the gang that goes into this bar, they don't look like actors. They look like they're not particularly attractive people. And I feel like today, if you made that movie, they'd be all Hollywood and gussied up, and you'd sort of, you wouldn't like them, but you'd still be drawn to them a little bit. And there's nothing attractive about these guys.
You know, they're interesting characters. And I think a lot of times, though, when we do that whole game of this wouldn't happen today, and I see it all the time, my inclination is to think, who's trying to do it today? I think people acquiesce, and people, by that I mean, they just are going to parrot what they see. So I believe, and I have to believe, that if someone said, no, we're doing it this way, and it was a workable idea and a strong idea, and they had the platform, that it would work and people would take to it. What interests me as well about the bad guys in this picture is the level of the language. So like the leader of the bad guys, not like the older guy, but like the sort of foot soldier leader of the other idiot foot soldiers, is not himself that much of an idiot. And you get a sense for the dynamic within this gang. And it's also like social commentary, like people are striking, people are out of work. Mm. This is what people do. Look how many mentally ill people became even more mentally ill over the last 2 years because of COVID, because people can't be alone with themselves for 5 minutes. Mm. So I thought, this is a pretty forward-thinking film. And there really aren't any duff moments in it. I'm not saying that something like you need the Blu-ray and to study it once a week, like it chimes at midnight or anything like that. But it's really like serviceable B+. B-level, like we had those films in the 50s where you'd go to this horror film and it would be this offbeat surprise. So this film from 1983 in color strikes me as like a throwback to the late 40s, early 50s, that offbeat B-horror type film that pleasantly surprises you. Maybe not you as much, but yeah.
And because I think at that time in America, and I don't know if this was a successful film at the box office in Canada or other places, but what were people making at that level of filmmaking in the United States? And it was a lot of the really raunchy sex comedies, and there certainly weren't a lot of deep messages in most of those.
No, it's a dirty, and I mean that in a good way, it's like a dirty sort of like caked in grime film. It's obviously far removed from a documentary, but it also has that realism to it. I mean, the setting is probably just like the cheapest thing that they could get. But the idea of this apartment block and the setup of the actual house is strange, right? It's almost like a ship, the way they're going through like corridors. Mm. The friends who are the neighbors, like they go through the skylights up above, and there's this weird narrow ladder that like you use to go up to like a different floor. And you think like, what kind of tank town, because it's very much a tank town, but like what sort of place are we in? And it's just this one building on its own, like, traffic island, and no one else is around. It's sort of like the Searchers, don't you think?
Mm, yeah,
you
oh, yeah.
These sort of Native American attacks, and there was nothing you could do about it, and your neighbors lived far away, and they wouldn't find out until, like, the next day or the next week or whatever it was, because those were the closest neighbors. And it's like the police film, Assault on Precinct, what was it, 49? It's sort of like that, but more, it's like this urban agrarian mashup. It's, when I see that apartment blocks, I just think, this is foreboding. It's real. It looks lived in, and there aren't really any moments that you get a lot of times with 80s horror where you're like, where you groan. You think, come on, that's what we're doing. And we've talked about plenty of those films over the years, but it surprised me, really, I guess is what I would say about it.
Well, you can find it online, Siege or Self-Defense, and it is a powerful watch, to say the least here. Colin Fleming, thank you. As always, Colin's book, the newest one, If You, brackets, Fabula Fantasy, Effery Hope, is available everywhere, as well as his book on Sam Cooke, live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. And you're doing a book talk in a couple of weeks, right?
Oh, I am, yes. Well, allowing that I can work the Zoom, and I have a really slow computer, and hopefully it'll be okay, but it's April 19th, that's a Tuesday, and don't worry, Downtown Inns, I won't bail on you, I will just be doing this after, and you can register, and you can go to my Twitter, and I'll put it up on the website, and the blog, which I haven't updated in a long time, and you can go on, and I'll talk about Sam Cooke, and I'll do my thing, and I'll read a little bit, and I'll answer questions. And you can heckle me and, like, say rude things, and I'll call you out and pick your question to answer. And maybe like 50 people will listen. Help me get to 50.
That's our goal. We'll get you there, Colin. Thank you, my friend. We'll talk next week.
All right. I'll see you later.
Colin Fleming on Downtown.